Bible reading is John 20, 24 to 31. John 20, 24 to 31. Okay. Jesus appears to Thomas. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with their disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen me and yet have believed." Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name.
Thank you. Thanks, Erica. Okay, am I on? Morning, everyone. I used to be a school teacher too, can you tell the way I do that? That's a school teacher thing. Yeah, I love school teachers, Julie. And we just needed to get the message right, didn't we? Okay. Those bags need to be gone. It's good to be here today. Good morning. And, you know, it's the lead up to Easter, which is just such an important time of year for us. Not that we don't remember the cross and the resurrection all the time. Of course we do. It's at the heart of our faith. But it's nice to have that time of year where we just make a special kind of point of it, don't we? And in some ways, as we come into next week, we kind of go through that journey of those 3 days. We kind of come into that Good Friday, which is that difficult time of remembering what our Lord and Saviour went through for us. But then we step through that into the joy of the resurrection and the hope and how that just changes everything. And so we look forward to this special time. This is the week before that. And I thought I'd take us off on a different direction. You can see the title up there, The Benefit of the Doubt. I want to ask that question as we lead into Easter. Have you ever wondered if it's actually really true? The death and the resurrection. Have you ever allowed a little bit of doubt to creep in about these things? We don't tend to talk about doubt very much, do we? It's kind of maybe dangerous territory. I don't know. Is it okay to talk about doubt? It is. Because it's real. It is real. And aren't there many people at a time like this when all these things are happening around us here in Lismore, but in our world? Oh, there must be a whole bunch of people that are wondering, you know, whether it could possibly make sense to believe in a good and powerful God. You know, this whole story about God entering our world, Jesus, because he loves us so much, to show us what his love looks like, loving us so much to even go to the cross, and yet so good and so powerful that not even death could hold him down, rising again 3 days later so that we can have this hope that nothing can steal away, new life. I mean, where is that God now in the midst of all this? Right? Is that just really a fanciful kind of a story? Is it wishful thinking? You know, is it wrong to ever wonder? That's my question today. Is it wrong to ever wonder? I think maybe sometimes we're worried that if we admit we sometimes have those little doubts, that it might ruin our witness to people who aren't Christians yet. You know, it might kind of mess things up a bit if we don't come across as fully confident all the time. But what do you think? Do you think it really does help our witness if we pretend we've got all the answers all the time? I don't reckon so either. Do you think maybe sometimes we're actually worried about admitting doubt in the presence of other Christians? I mean, Christians don't always kind of respond well to questioning, do we? Many of you would be aware of Philip Yancey. Aware of Philip Yancey? He's a well-known Christian author. He's got a website and he's got a section dedicated to faith and doubt. And there I found this. He says, this is his own experience. He says, as a child, I attended a church that had little room for inquisitiveness. Have you ever had that kind of experience? I think lots of Christians have, yeah? He says, if you doubted or questioned, you sinned. I learned to conform, as you must in a church like that. But as he goes on to say, meanwhile, those deep doubts, those deep questions didn't get answered in a satisfactory way. They didn't go away. Right? The danger of such a church like that, and there are many, is that by saying don't doubt, just believe, you don't really resolve the doubts and they tend to resurface in a more toxic form, this kind of idea. Okay, maybe we're worried about admitting our doubts in the presence of unbelievers, maybe in the presence of believers, maybe in the presence of ourselves. Now, maybe we're worried. You know, we want to convince ourselves because if we admit, you know, or kind of listen to some of those questions, we might actually be afraid that our faith won't be able to stand up to the questions that might really be there. So we try to bury them. But I would say this, and I'm sure many of you would agree, if our faith can't stand up to the questioning, shouldn't we just get on with pushing it over and stop wasting our time? There's a guy called Oz Guinness, a theologian. He wrote a very similar thing, except with much better words. He said, if ours is an examined faith, we should be unafraid to doubt. If doubt is eventually justified, we were believing what clearly was not worth believing. But if doubt is answered, our faith has grown stronger. Right? It knows God more certainly and it can enjoy God more deeply. So all that to say, let me invite you this morning to give ourselves permission just to think a little bit about doubt. Let's think a bit about doubt this morning. Now, there are, of course, different kinds of doubt, aren't there? And you might think about this in different ways. But I found this in a book by John Dixon. People familiar with John Dixon, another well-known Australian Christian author. And he's got this classic. It's been around for years. It's called Hanging in There, a book called Hanging in There. And his in a section of that book, he talks about four types of doubt. He kind of classifies them this way. I think it's kind of helpful. And the first one that he suggests is proud doubt. He says one kind of doubt is proud doubt. He defines it this way. He says an example would be saying, I don't believe in God because he condemns sexual freedom, for example. It's like saying we know better than God. But the logic, of course, is all wrong, isn't it? It's silly to say that you don't believe something just because you don't like something about it. It's either real or it isn't. Right? That's proud doubt. Another kind of doubt that he suggests we might kind of acknowledge is, he calls it brain doubt. Brain doubt. This isn't about refusing to believe because we don't like it. This is about finding something difficult to believe, struggling to accept that something could be true. So the answer there, according to John Dixon, and I agree with him, is simply to do the hard work and study the issue properly, right? Really kind of invest yourself into working it out. So I remember, for example, as a young person, being in turmoil for a long time around a question. I've been taught a very clear version of predestination where, you know, it's said that we only come to God if God chooses us. And as a young person, I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking, that doesn't sound fair. What about, you know, it doesn't seem to fit with what I also believed about the justice and the love of God and the idea of free will, people choosing him. And, you know, so to put it bluntly, how could he condemn people to hell just because he didn't choose them. You know that whole question? You guys got that one worked out? Do you want to know the answer? That's another sermon, right? But let me say, it was a big one for me, and it took a while, but eventually I discovered that there are biblically grounded, intellectually rigorous, right, reasonable and rational answers to that dilemma. They exist. Now, you can talk to me about it later if you're wondering. But let me say, the point I want to make is this. Do you think if I just tried to ignore those kind of questions or doubts, they'd have gone away? They wouldn't. They'd be there still. You know, a common example of brain doubt is wondering if I could ever be good enough for God. How could God accept me? That's a common one. And the answer there, of course, is to take another look at who God is and how he operates, how he relates to us. Take a closer look. Okay, brain doubt. The third one he talks about is worry doubt. Worry doubt. Now, that's where we might question the existence or goodness or love of God because we're scared of being let down if we're wrong. Right? Now, working through the emotional background to that kind of doubt can be a bit tricky. But there it is, worry doubt. Fourth one he talks about is slack doubt. I reckon this is a biggie. I really do. You know where we're going with that one? It's the one where, you know, you don't just get up and say, oh, I doubt that God exists one day. You look into the issues and you say, I just don't think that's real. It's the kind of doubt that emerges over time when we allow the busyness of life to crowd out our faith life. And so we kind of just fail to invest like we should in things like our personal prayer life or our Bible reading or meeting with other believers, letting our faith actually shape our life. And if we kind of just let that happen over time, you know, one day we wake up and we say, hang on, I actually don't know that I believe that stuff anymore. That's what we might call slack doubt. The answer, according to John Dixon, is simple but brutal. He says, we've got to get our act together and start trusting God again. Okay, you know, there it is. Four kinds of doubt. Now, you might be able to think of different ways, different kinds of doubt or different ways of classifying, but hopefully that's helpful. Let's turn to Thomas and let's see if we can work out what kind of doubt he was experiencing in that little kind of account that we read earlier. What do we think? Okay, now, the context, if we can just put it in there, because I only asked Erica to read a few verses there. We're actually post the crucifixion, post the resurrection actually, though Thomas hasn't worked that out yet. And at this point, we're told the disciples are hiding, right? They've got the doors locked because they're scared of the Jewish leaders. They're in their hiding. Now, Jesus, before he went to the cross, he'd spoken about rising again. Right, but somehow it just never really seemed to compute with those disciples. Maybe, you know, it was just, it was too far outside their sense, I think, of what could possibly happen. Maybe they thought he was speaking metaphorically or something like that. I don't know. But somehow it didn't land there. But then after the crucifixion, right, 3 days later, these reports start coming through, don't they? First, you've got the women who go to the tomb. Then you've got Peter and John. Then you've got those two on the road to Emmaus. And then on that first Sunday, Easter Sunday evening, you've got the 10 who were there when Jesus appeared. So that's the context for what happens here now. So if we look again at verses 24 and 25 of chapter 20 of John's Gospel, we read, now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we've seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were, put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Pretty straightforward, isn't he? What kind of doubt is this, do you think? Yeah, a bit of brain doubt going on. It's probably not. It doesn't sound like proud doubt to me. I don't think that's what's going on. And I don't think it's slack doubt. There's probably definitely an element of brain doubt. I mean, what's Thomas just seen? He's seen Jesus hanging on a cross, right? Now, people don't generally, you know, get up after something like that, right? People don't generally rise from the dead. And I reckon lots of people would find this difficult to believe. And in fact, it really is a key kind of belief for our faith, isn't it? If the resurrection is real, it changes everything. But it's a big deal, believing the resurrection. So you can easily imagine brain doubt going on there. But, you know, I would say this. I don't think that's the only thing going on for Thomas. Because remember, he's not a modern-day secular materialist, is he? He's a first-century Jew who believes in the God of the Old Testament. And all those things, all those stories, all those possibilities with that God. And in fact, we're told in John's Gospel that Thomas was there when Jesus rose Lazarus from the dead. So he's seen it happen. I'm sure there's an element of brain doubt, but I reckon worry doubt is a big part of it for him. Think about it. Thomas had invested so much, hadn't he? In trusting in and in following this Jesus as the Messiah. All his hopes invested in this Jesus. And yet, he'd then seen all these hopes kind of smashed as Jesus was hanging there on the cross. I mean, that's not what happens to a Messiah, is it? And so, you know, we might just put ourselves in his shoes. Can you sense his agony? You know, as he's been through this experience, you know, I'd love it to be true that Jesus is alive, he might be thinking. But I'm not going to talk myself into believing it just because I want it to be true. It's got to be better than that. Right? I'm not going to make that mistake again. Right? If I'm going to believe this, I've got to be 100% certain. No kind of lookalikes or twins or something like that. I need serious evidence. I've got to see and touch those wounds. Right? Can you imagine this kind of thinking? Worry doubt. I think sometimes we paint Thomas in a pretty negative light, you know. Doubting Thomas. Don't be like that guy, you know. Don't be like that guy. But maybe, just maybe, we need sometimes at least to be more like him. More like him. Making sure that we're not believing things just because we want to believe them. Right? If we never seriously test our ideas or allow those questions to challenge us, what are we going to end up with? Superficial, immature faith that probably won't stand up well under the first real time of testing, whether that's due to persecution or just tough times or temptation or some intellectual challenge, whatever it is. Now, I'm not saying here that doubt is always good, especially when it's proud doubt or slack doubt. And neither am I saying that we should be happy to wallow in doubt, no matter what kind it is. I'm not saying any of those things. But what I am saying is, I don't reckon we need to be afraid of it either. I don't think we need to be afraid of it. And we can even grow through it. It's important, actually, for our growth, in a way. You know, God himself in the Bible seems to be quite doubt tolerant. Have you noticed? Look at some of the Psalms. What's the classic book of the Bible about doubt? It's the book of Job, isn't it? Right, he's going, God, what's going on here? And you know, as Job was the one who cried out against God and questioned God, and yet what's the kind of wash up of that whole account? He's kind of like, he emerges as the hero. He's affirmed by God, in contrast to his theologically way more respectable friends. So do you see? God seems to be able to cope with doubt. A measure of doubt and questioning can be a good thing, even a very, very helpful thing, ultimately, on our Christian journey. Let's make sure that we're believing stuff that's real. Right? That's where doubt can help us. Okay, so we talked about doubt. Let's talk about faith. Verses 26 to 28. Let's read them again. It says a week later. So a week's gone past. His disciples are still there again, in the house again, with the door locked, right? Thomas was with them. Okay? This time, Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand, put it into my side, stop doubting and believe." And Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God, my Lord and my God." So weeks passed, disciples still hiding away in this house. This time Thomas is there, Jesus appears, he wishes them peace, and then he invites Thomas to touch his wounds. Now just think about this for a minute. Imagine being Thomas at this point in time. This is pretty real, isn't it? Touch my wounds. Have you ever wanted to touch someone's wounds? No, me neither. No. Again, you can imagine Thomas thinking, well, actually, maybe not. now that it comes to it. And, you know, I mean, if you've got a wound, do you want people to touch it? No, you don't. You don't, generally speaking. Hats off to those nurses, hey, who look after us at times like that. Yeah, it's actually quite an intimate moment when you think about it. Jesus' gentle grace, offering Thomas what he believed he needed. And how did Thomas respond? How did he respond? "My Lord and my God. My Lord and my God." Now, that's a tough one, isn't it? For those who want to deny that Jesus is God. Thomas, "My Lord and my God." And I understand that, just thinking about this for a minute, and we've got some family connections here, I understand that Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, have a number of answers explanations to explain this kind of statement away from Thomas. One of the most best known ones, I think, is this idea that he didn't say, "My Lord and my God." What he actually said was, "My Lord, my God," you know, as though the first thing that Thomas, who was a devout Jew, did on seeing the risen Christ was blasphemy, right? and then that Jesus commended him for it. And then, of course, there's that little word, "and," "my Lord and my God." Still, think about what he said. Pretty extreme, isn't it? Couldn't he just have said, "Oh, wow, you actually are alive. I was wrong." He could have said that, couldn't he? But instead he says, "My Lord and my God." You know, there are others in the Bible who died and rose again, but no one fell before them and called them God, did they? But here, let's put ourselves again in Thomas's shoes, okay? It's been a week. He's had a week to think about this stuff. So, you know, he might be thinking, he can't be alive. I mean, it would be fantastic if he was, but... You know, there were those women, but it wasn't just those women. It was, you know, the two on the road. There was even the ten. But how could it be true? The Messiah, he couldn't have been. If he's the Messiah, he couldn't have been crucified. It just doesn't fit. But then you can imagine him as he allows these ideas. You can imagine him remembering how Jesus did, you know, he walked on water, didn't he? He healed the sick. He cast out demons. He'd be remembering these things. He would probably remember some of Jesus' words when Jesus said, you know, to the Pharisees, "If you knew me, you would know my Father also." You know, and then there was that time that they wanted to stone him when he said, "Before Abraham was, I am." They knew, you know, he made these outrageous claims. He'd be thinking about all, you can imagine all this percolating away for Thomas, so that when Thomas finally sees and is invited to touch those wounds with Jesus before him, risen, right, graciously inviting him to believe, you can imagine it all just finally washing through him and overflowing into this beautiful just expression of faith. Now, don't you reckon that this would be a faith worth having? kind of faith we see expressed by Thomas at this point, try pushing that faith over now. Right? Honest doubt that isn't motivated by pride and that really hangs in there, right, and that continues to grapple with the evidence, it can be a very healthy, helpful thing. It can be. So let me ask you, where are you in all of that? Have you really grappled with your faith? And can you, with the same conviction, say, my Lord and my God, my Lord and my God? Okay. Doubt, faith, witness, verse 29. We read this. Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. There it is. It kind of looks, doesn't it, like Jesus is commending Thomas, but he's saying, but if you don't need to see the evidence, then that's even better, right? It's almost like he's saying, wanting evidence is a bad thing. But is that actually what he's saying? I mean, maybe we like that idea in our postmodern world because we kind of like to think of faith sometimes, don't we, as something that is purely personal, something that is subjective, if you want to debate it as though objective truth has anything to do with matters like that, well, that's just plain rude, right, in our context today. So maybe we like this notion that evidence, you know, is a bad thing to want. And yet, biblically, I don't reckon that notion stands. I mean, Paul the Apostle is the one in 1 Corinthians 15:17 who said very clearly, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile, right? You're wasting your time if it's not real. That's what he says. Faith's value depends on whether that which is believed is actually true. It can't just be wishful thinking. That's not good enough. Now, that doesn't mean that we can prove Christian faith, because I don't think we can. I don't think we can prove it. But we can certainly weigh up the evidence, you know. But, of course, unless God's Spirit comes in and grit takes hold of our hearts, we're never going to truly believe that good news, the gospel. It's never going to land home. But a faith that pretends that reality or evidence or challenging questions don't matter is a weak and a vulnerable faith. Do you agree? Something to think about? Jesus knew that many would come after Thomas who wouldn't have the benefit of being able to touch and see his risen body in that way. You know, people like us. That's us, isn't it? Our access to the resurrection and the evidence for the resurrection isn't through seeing the risen Jesus like that, but it's what? It's through those first witnesses. And it's through the record of what happened with those first witnesses that we find in places like the Bible, in John's Gospel, and this, including this account that we've just read. And that is why John says those words in verses 30 to 31. He says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe. Here's the evidence. Think about it. Grapple with it. That you may believe that Jesus actually is the Messiah, that he is the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. It matters. The evidence matters. John is calling us to consider the witness of all that is recorded, including this story about Thomas that we've been looking at today. He's saying, weigh up the evidence, grapple with it, check it out, and may you on that basis then believe and have life in Jesus. When Jesus rose from the dead, it changed everything. Everything changed, and it's going to be so good to celebrate and remember that next week. But don't be lazy, don't be proud, but keep searching and studying with an open and humble heart till this might be your firm conviction, the resurrection. So, in Mark chapter 9, verses 23 to 24, you've got this guy who goes to Jesus and he begs him to heal his son. And Jesus' response to him is he says, everything is possible for the one who believes. Do you remember that story? Do you remember how that man responds? He says, I do believe. Help me to overcome my unbelief. Didn't he? So he believes, he's got faith, but there's also that doubt as well. But here's the thing about that guy. What did he do in response to his doubt? Did he sit at home and wallow in it? He didn't, did he? He got out there and he acted on the bit of faith that he did have, and he went to Jesus. And what was the result? What did he see? He saw the power and love of Jesus in action. Do you know what? God works with us, even with our doubt. He'll work with that bit of faith that we've got if we continue to, you know, turn to him. We can go forward in faith, even with our doubts. How thankful can we be about that? We don't need to pretend. I love that we don't need to pretend. Okay, let's pray. Oh God, we want to thank you that you are bigger than our doubts, and that you invite us to be honest and to question where we've got those questions. Don't ever let us be slack in that. Don't let us be lazy. Don't let us be proud. Give us humble, seeking hearts, honest hearts, because we know that as we seek you, you will open that door to faith. You will provide us what we need. Help us to go to you in the meantime, even with our doubts. And help us by your grace and spirit to perceive and to trust in the truth and wonder of your risen Son, Jesus. Amen.